and welcome to COVIDcast. This is a weekly Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on global politics and international life. My name is Alex Oliver and I'm the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we've been sitting down every week with Lowy Institute experts to discuss the implications of COVID-19 for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Roland Raja about the implications of the coronavirus pandemic for the international economy. Roland, for those of you who don't know him, is the director of the International Economy Program here at the Institute and our lead international economist. Thank you, Roland, for joining me today.
Thanks, Alex.
Right, we're going to start with the shock to the world's economy from COVID-19. That's been very obvious in the last few weeks. And you've written quite a bit about this. You wrote it a piece in a digital research feature, which we published last week, looking at various aspects of how the world might look after COVID-19. And you observe that there's currently a debate amongst economists as to whether the shock of this virus is going to be permanent or long-standing or more temporary. And before we get to your own view on this, I thought perhaps you could outline for us what the thinking is behind each of those views.
Thanks, Alex. Well, I mean, the temporary shock perspective is simply the idea that the virus will eventually pass, and when it does, economic life can basically just go back to normal. Nothing too much has to change, and there isn't too much permanent damage. And you can see that view anytime you see economists forecasting anything that looks like a so-called V-shaped recovery or a relatively quick bounce back to normal. Conversely, the idea that there might be more permanent damage is basically that while the economy is depressed, a lot of damage is done, which you can't necessarily avoid or undo very easily. So for workers, some jobs may simply never come back. They might be permanently lost. People will drop out of the labor force, never to return. Skills atrophy while they're not being used. And household balance sheets get damaged. People become more indebted or they're forced to draw down on their savings. And then when you think about businesses, their balance sheets also get damaged or they might go bankrupt. And then that not only destroys businesses and jobs, but also reduces investment and it can destroy a lot of intangible capital to the knowledge embedded in businesses or organizational systems, business networks, and so on. And then the damage could really escalate if it hits the financial systems in a major way. And then that would really magnify all the damage significantly. Of course, the reality is that it's never a completely temporary shock or a permanent shock. It always exists on a bit of a spectrum. And so the question is whether it's mostly going to be a temporary shock or mostly going to be one where there's a lot of longer lasting damage. And the final point is, of course, that the huge fiscal and monetary policy responses that we've seen in many Western countries are basically aiming to try and minimize that permanent damage. And so the other question, or perhaps the most important question, is how successful that will ultimately be.
I guess one of the factors which mitigates and puts this in favour of a temporary shock is going to be record low borrowing rates. How does that impact your analysis?
Well, I think that's what allows the government to really step in. I mean, the way I try and think about the economics of the shock is that, of course, this is a real thing, a real loss in revenue and income and economic activity. It has to hit somewhere across the various parts of the economy. There's households, there's businesses, there's banks and the financial system, and then there's the government. Now, in my view, the most healthy place to try and take all of this damage and shift all of the burden is onto the government balance sheet rather than anyone else's balance sheet, because otherwise you're going to have a lot more permanent effects. Investment's going to remain depressed and spending's going to be depressed for much longer. And one of the major reasons why, you know, sort of socializing the costs of the economic hibernation onto the government balance sheet is the best option is because interest rates are such historical lows and negative after accounting for inflation. So the government can actually borrow for over very long time horizons at negative real interest rates. So that's a key reason that facilitates the government taking on a lot of this burden. Yes, debt is going to be higher. There will be issues around that. But as long as long-term interest rates remain low, there's a lot of scope to reduce a lot of the damage and enable a faster recovery.
I'm sensing from the way you've described this that you're very much leaning towards the longer lasting shock view. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, for me, there are three sort of factors that really lean me towards thinking there are going to be much stronger permanent effects from this shock. The first thing is, of course, that there is going to be some permanent damage. I don't think it's realistic, as broadly good as I think a lot of the economic responses have been in most Western countries. At the end of the day, it's unrealistic to expect that to catch everything and prevent any damage from seeping through. And so the first reason why I think there will be a fair bit of permanent damage is basically, you know, this virus and the virus economy that it has created is last a lot longer than we originally thought. So at first it was supposed to be something that might last only 1 or 2 months, then it became 3 to 6 months. Now there's talk of it taking maybe 12 to 18 months to see the other end of this. There's some concern that people can even get reinfected after recovering. And of course, there's still a huge amount of uncertainty about when effective treatments or a vaccine might be found. And so one reason why one might expect more permanent damage is simply that the virus economy itself is lasting a lot longer than we thought. And that means more permanent damage is going to accumulate. The second thing is that this is, of course, a global health crisis. And so even if an individual country is able to defeat the virus at home, they will still have to keep their borders closed to avoid reinfection from abroad. And so things like tourism, education exports, business travel, these things can't actually return to normal until the rest of the world also overcomes the virus. And then in a more export sort of focus way, the other factor is that if other countries are struggling to offset the economic damage of the virus, then world demand is going to stay depressed, and that will hit everyone's exports and slow their recovery, even if your individual country is able to manage the pandemic relatively well. And I think a big risk there in particular is the emerging and developing world, and we can talk about more about that later, but I think they're set to be hit very hard by the virus. These days they account for some 60% of global output. So a severe or prolonged economic crisis in the emerging and developing world is going to have big implications for everyone. And then the final reason to expect more permanent effects is just that some things will inevitably change once we enter the post-virus world, if they're not already happening now. And one of the big ones to me is globalization. I think this is going to take a very big hit. It's not going to completely unravel. I think the networks and the foundations and the commercial logic are, you know, they just run too deep and are too strong. But when we think about things from a longer term perspective, globalization was already heading in reverse according to a number of measures in terms of cross-border trade, in terms of cross-border investment, in terms of the movement of people and migration. And so that trend's probably only going to be reinforced by the virus experience. You know, firms will rethink their supply chains, governments will feel compelled to have more domestic capacity in key areas like the PPE, personal protective equipment, and pharmaceuticals. You can imagine protectionists in general feeling fairly empowered and more barriers to people moving across borders, including due to health reasons, being erected. And, you know, when we think in this longer term perspective, globalization was a key driver of faster growth before the global financial crisis in 2008-09. Then after that crisis, less globalization was a key driver of why we saw much slower growth after the GFC. And again, if we see another step down in globalization after the virus, then that's going to again mean even slower growth at the global level going forward.
Yes, well, one thing that's certainly reinforcing globalization is the global impact of this virus economy. And speaking of global impact, I know the IMF forecasts came out yesterday, providing an assessment of the global economic impact of the virus. And the headline forecast, which seemed surprising and perhaps optimistic to me, was that the global economy would shrink just 3% this year, according to the forecast, but in fact grow 6% next year. What's your assessment of that forecast?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of criticism amongst economists that these forecasts are basically too optimistic, and I would agree with that. But I'll make a few comments on the IMF's specific forecast. First, that the 3% contraction and the 6% bounce back, that is, in a sense, when you read their report, their rosiest best case scenario. But even for a best case scenario, the assumptions they're using look too optimistic to me. I mean, they're assuming that the lockdowns will peak in the second quarter, so this quarter, and then recede from here, that there would be no widespread bankruptcies, permanent job losses, or major damage to financial systems. So those are pretty rosy assumptions, even for a best case scenario. But when you think about that really rosy best case scenario, it's much more pessimistic than it looks also, because by the time you get to the end of 2021 using these IMF baseline forecasts, the global economy will have already lost at least $5 trillion compared to what would have happened in terms of global economic output if there had been no virus. That means by the end of 2021, we'd still be missing an economy the size of a Japan or a Germany. And the other thing is that within the IMF's analysis, they always produce a range of scenarios, and they also produce some more negative scenarios, which actually I think might serve as a more realistic baseline for thinking about where the global economy is headed. And so for their most negative scenario, the global economy would contract by 6% in 2020 and basically see zero growth in 2021. And by the time you get to the end of 2021, you're basically missing about $17 trillion compared to a situation where if there hadn't been no virus. And that basically equates to missing an economy almost the size of the entire US economy or the entire euro area. So that's a much more negative assessment. And in my view, it's probably a more realistic baseline for where we're headed. But also even then, the risks are still further to the downside.
I want to talk about the G20. This is something you've written about as well, and the important role the G20 played in responding to the global financial crisis, where it delivered a coordinated stimulus and took measures against sort of galloping protectionist tendencies. The G20 Finance Action Plan, I think, was released today. It's been a little bit quiet on the pandemic to date. What's in the action plan, and is it going to be effective?
Yeah, I think the action plan, unfortunately, it was as expected. There was a bit of telegraphing of what was going to be in the action plan. So it was as expected, but it was overall quite disappointing. I mean, the big difference between the GFC situation and today's situation is this is really a true global economic shock. All countries are being affected by the virus in a similar way. And that means all countries are facing a very deep internal as well as external shock. Whereas when it came to the GFC, actually, this was really a North Atlantic crisis. It was really a problem within the economies of the United States and Western Europe. And them getting their own houses in order was the main thing that needed to be done. And for a lot of the rest of the world, that was where the benefits were going to be had, and their actual own economies weren't necessarily suffering in an internal way. That's very different today, where all countries around the world are being hit by this virus. The biggest need today really is amongst the emerging and developing economies. There's been a lot of recognition within the G20 and from world leaders that basically the emerging world is really unprepared and really vulnerable for the crisis that is still coming in many ways for them. There's a health component to that, of course, given they have weak health systems and it's not easy to social distance in those environments or impose long lockdowns. But also on the economic front as well, those countries are very vulnerable because they can't run those massive fiscal and monetary policy expansion programs to keep their economies and their societies afloat. So that then means a lot more permanent damage is likely in those countries. And then for a lot of the emerging economies, there's been capital flight of investors basically fleeing in droves from emerging economies. Some $100 billion has been pulled out of emerging economies since late January, which is a really violent and unprecedented withdrawal of funds from these countries. And so that was the challenge that basically the G20 needed to step up against. Unfortunately, the reality is that they've significantly under-delivered against what the need basically is. I mean, what these economies need is a ton of external financing. They need it quickly, and they need it mainly coming from official sources because it's not going to come from the private sector. So that means it needs to come from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the multilatural development banks, particularly the World Bank, as well as it can come from rich country governments. So what have we seen so far? Well, the IMF has suggested that minimum estimate of the financing shortfall for the emerging world is $2.5 trillion. Right now, the IMF and the multilateral development banks probably have about $1 trillion in total between them for additional financing. So that still leaves a $1.5 trillion gap. Now, what did we see from the G20 overnight? Well, we saw no new money. That immediately tells you the way in which they haven't been able to deliver on what was needed. The big news item was a standstill on debt repayments for the poorest countries, having to repay debt to official bilateral creditors, which is mostly a story about Chinese loans in Africa. That's something. It's worth about $20 billion. So clearly, it's going to be material for those countries that get that, where that's important. They're mostly in Africa, but at a global level, it's quite small fry. And then the other things that they announced were basically fairly small tweaks to existing IMF arrangements, which I don't think are necessarily going to be particularly strong game changers. And there was a reluctance to go for the really big ticket item, which had been suggested by a number of world leaders, particularly out of Europe and Africa, for a giant issuance of the IMF's reserve asset, the special drawing right, anywhere from $500 billion, some people calling for, to $1 trillion to $3 trillion, which would have basically provided an immediate reserves of all countries, but especially the emerging world. But that didn't happen. And the story is that that was blocked by the United States. So a big funding gap basically remained. Maybe it'll be addressed in the future, but so far, not enough is being done.
Speaking about doing enough, I think you've come up with an idea which you talked about on the Interpreter ILO Institute online magazine yesterday about external funding for, you know, some of these emerging economies that are really struggling with those financing shortfalls. You argue that Australia should extend a large loan, a very large loan to the tune of $10 billion to Indonesia at relatively low or no cost to Australia to help Indonesia ride out the crisis. Is that feasible? Is there any sort of precedent for that sort of financing facility?
Well, I think it's very feasible, and I think it would certainly pass what I think would be a reasonable cost-benefit analysis in terms of public policy. I mean, the specific proposal is that this would be a standby loan for $10 billion US, but that would be $16 billion in Australian dollars, which is equal to about 1% of Indonesia's GDP. So it's pretty substantial. And how this would work is that we would commit to providing the loan if Indonesia was unable to raise the fund from the market at reasonable cost. So it would operate as a bit of a backstop or insurance arrangement. And the main benefit is that it would serve to boost market confidence. It doesn't even necessarily have to be drawn down. And we have, in fact, had experience in this type of arrangement before. We did something similar in the 2009 for Indonesia in the global financial crisis, and again in 2013 during the taper tantrum. The difference is back then it was about $1 billion, and this time we basically need a lot more money. It's going to be a lot more politically difficult because our own budget is, of course, exploding and our own economy is taking a battering. And so one of the specific elements of my proposal there is that, unlike in the past, we don't necessarily have to make this a cheap loan. That's not what Indonesia needs. It just needs to be able to borrow in normal market rates, but at scale. And that's what we could provide to them. And in which case, there would actually not be any hit to the Australian budget's bottom line.
Sounds useful. I want to just finally move on to China's position in the region. Some commentators have suggested that China is going to use this situation to further consolidate its influence in these sort of countries in the region who are looking frantically for very external assistance. China's Belt and Road Initiative has already changed the dynamics in the region. Is it likely to use this crisis to consolidate that initiative and embed it more deeply in the economies of the region?
I think that inevitably it will. We haven't seen a great deal of it just yet, but it's still very early days, and this is something that will play out over probably over a number of years. China has a lot of ability to provide some financing. I do think, on the other hand, though, that a lot of people overestimate China's ability to do so. I think the limits for China doing this is basically that, one, it doesn't have the US dollar the way the United States does. It doesn't have the global reserve currency. And that means that any financing that it's sending overseas, either directly or indirectly, puts pressure on its own foreign exchange reserves. Now, a lot of people would look at that and say, that's $3 trillion. That's a lot. But the reality is that China actually needs that to protect its own currency, so it can't afford to waste it. So China does have a fair bit of scope to provide some meaningful financing to the rest of the world, but it can't do it alone. So from an economic standpoint, there's reasons for others to also step up. But from a geopolitical standpoint as well, China will only get the upper hand if Western countries basically don't do anything themselves. And we also have a fair bit of capacity to step up as well.
Well, thank you, Roland, for joining me for that discussion on geoeconomics and the novel coronavirus. Thank you all for listening. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues Sandra Rigby and Jennifer Reinhardt for production assistance today. Please keep an eye out on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast, and you can stay up to date with all of the latest developments on the coronavirus and its international impact via our widely read digital magazine, the Lowy Institute Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and please watch out for the next instalment of COVIDcast next week.